Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the December 26th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You would normally find my friend David Bonson here, but he's off this week and next. And so with me today is my friend Jim Righeimer. He is a, is it fair to say you're a real estate developer? Is that kind of what you do these
yeah,
days?
I develop communities.
You develop communities?
I don't build the houses. I do the communities. I put the parks in and the trails in and the bike paths. I mean, development now is a lot different than it used to be, especially in the West, not in California, such mostly in other states that have room to grow.
Get to that, too. And you were the reason we know each other is because I used to run the left-wing newspaper here, OC Weekly, and you were a rising star in the conservative movement, the Republican Party in particular. And then you became mayor of Costa Mesa and participated in events over the course of years that really put the nails in the coffin of my my sort of vestigial leftism by that point. And I wonder, just before we get to our real show here, let's preface it by talking about the fact that what happened there. You get elected mayor. You were trying to, I think, reorganize the city's relationship to its government unions, its cops, firefighters, admin people, everybody. And then what happens?
Well, I mean, my career as far as politics goes, my avocation with politics goes back to doing the first Paycheck Protection Initiative, which basically said that if you belong to a union, you shouldn't be forced to pay for politics you don't agree with. And as a young guy, I remember we got that on the ballot, had no idea how powerful labor unions were. We were just in our 30s and didn't really have a clue. And the teachers union just came and crushed us. I mean, just beat the crap out of us. And so it was just basically, it was so obvious to us. It's like, why? You can't be forced to pay for politics. And they say, yeah, you can be. And now, of course, that's changed. We finally, since all that time, all these years gone by, we do have some federal court
Janus case,
right, which is just saying, hey, you can opt out of that. So when you start looking at how labor unions work, I don't have any problem with labor unions as far as people being represented and come together a group. I don't like whether it's labor unions or it's management that uses nefarious ways to fund themselves, make things work, you know, just play the wrong way. And so the biggest thing that we would see with the labor unions, they just had so much money, they could crush you, they could do whatever they wanted. Well, when I got into local politics, when I ran for city council, you know, the labor unions come to you immediately, and I'm a Republican, and my dad was a deputy sheriff in the Midwest. He's since passed. My brother's a retired cop. They know I'm all for the men in blue, men and women in blue, and I'm like, hey, I'm with you guys, but we do have an issue with this pension thing. Mm-hmm. This is a problem, and people outside of California may not know, but in California, our pensions are structured that you get 90% of pay after 30 years, basically. So if you started at 22, at 51, you retire, you get 90% of pay. It's an outrageous amount of money. It goes up with inflation. I mean, there's just no way out of this thing. And so when you hire somebody at any city, not just the what they call the public safety. I love how they use the word public safety. Mm-hmm. You want to buy some more public safety? Mm-hmm. Give me about 50,000 more safety, right? And so police.
Who's against that?
Yeah, who's against buying some public safety? But the reality of it is it's extremely expensive, and it just caused all sorts of problems. The first problem it happened is that everybody's retiring in the early 50s in age. And so you have no gray hair on the departments anymore. I mean, used to be where you weren't a sergeant until a certain age or a captain to a certain age, or you were the chief in your 60s. Now you hire chiefs in their 40s mm-hmm. because they're going to retire at 50. So you have no gray hair. How that comes into my case is when I was fighting this stuff, saying how outrageous it was, the unions were like, well, we'll show you. And they went out of their way to the point where they put tracking devices on other council members' cars. They set me up for a DUI. He literally came to my house.
Well, I think the details of that story, don't skip over them. And you can correct me. I mean, as I remember them, you go into a bar in Costa Mesa that is owned by a fellow council member.
Well, we'd finished a thing at another issue that happened with the union. about a neighbor that wasn't being taken care of, and the union, the police union, told people, go to the city council and say, we're not safe and you don't care.
Mm.
And I knew that was a setup. I knew it was because of how unions literally, the one main law firm that represented unions, literally had a book out, like a playbook that said, here's what you do. You send people to city council meetings and say, we're not safe and you don't care, and just, you know, all these things that make you bad when you're just trying to say, hey, wait a second. We're trying to negotiate a normal contract here, and you guys want benefits that nobody on the planet gets. But, hey, you want to be safe? You know, you go ahead and pay for it. And so we had gone to this event, you know, where we basically told the neighbor, we'll be there tomorrow with city staff, planning head of the planning commission, head of the different departments to solve the problems in your neighborhood. Drove back over to Gary Monahan, who was on the city council, had a restaurant bar. It's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I have a couple of Diet Cokes. I leave. Little did I know that inside that room, the unions had hired people to follow us. And so, sure enough.
Well, including a provocatively dressed woman standing
yes,
in the bar next to you.
Well, so one of the things they do it. This is Orange County, California. This is suburban county. And if you make a mistake as a council person and do something that your wife may not be very happy with, they will let you know,
mm-hmm.
and even if they set you up in that, at a honey
it's blackmail.
Track, it's total blackmail, and as this case went on, and
but you, so you order there's this woman standing at the bar. There's a guy, as I remembered, in the corner who
right.
turns out to be significant later.
Right.
You order your two Diet Cokes. You pay for them.
Right.
This is not a gift, even.
Right.
And you walk out your car and you drive home.
Right. And meanwhile, the guy inside texts the guy outside, saying, hey, Righeimer's coming out, watch him. And so the guy calls 911, says, hey, this guy's stumbling, he can't seem to get in his car, well, I'll just follow him for a minute. And he basically follows me the whole way home, talking to 911, saying that I'm blowing stop signs and I'm swerving and I'm doing all this stuff. I'm doing nothing. I'm just driving
home.
Well,
you were high on two Diet Cokes.
Exactly, the two Diet Cokes. And so that's what happened there. When I got home, my wife said there's a police car down the street, and I said, well, no big deal, honey. And a few minutes later, she said there's a policeman at the door. And again, it's not completely unusual for a police officer to come to a councilman's house to say, hey, we've had a problem in the neighborhood or something, that's why we're here. But he comes to me and he just says, sir, have you can you step outside first? And as soon as he said that, I'm like, oh, my God. I'm looking down at his gun, his belt, everything else. I'm thinking, I got to step outside. I'm not nobody. I'm an elected official. If I say, no, I'm not coming out, it's going to be a problem. Step outside. He says, have you been drinking? And I said, no. And he says, well, there have been calls that, you know, that you've been driving erratically, something to that effect. And I said, absolutely no. And he tests me, and he says, well, you're just fine. And I said, I know I'm fine. He says, okay, and he walks away. And I go back in the house. My wife said, the police officer's walking to somebody at the end of the block who's in a car. And I said, honey, we're in the middle of negotiations and I get pulled over in my house for a DUI. This is a setup. And I just took out the door, ran to that officer saying, what's going on? Who's that person in that car? This is a setup. We're under negotiations. This is what's happening. By the way, that's all on tape because the officer has his digital tape recorder on at the time. So it's all there. The officer says, oh, it's nothing, sir. And I said, what's his name? Oh, it's nobody. If anything had come out, we would have had it. But no, we're, you know, he just lets the guy go. What I didn't realize is my wife had actually walked out the house with me. Now, you can mess with me politically, but you cannot mess with Mama Bear. you're bringing this, you know, she knows about all the stuff. I get, you know, harassed by the unions, all that kind of stuff. But you don't bring it home. Now it's in our front door. So as I'm down at the end of the cul-de-sac, my wife goes out the door and stops the car. Just stands in front of it and stops the car. And the guy swerves around her and stops, rolls his window down. So what do you want? Something to that effect. She said, I just want to know who you are. If you, you know, called in what you thought was a DUI, that's fine. But just who are you? And he made some remark and literally just about ran her over. I mean, she could feel the heat on her foot from the thing. And she ran away. He took off. Within 24 hours, they found out who that person was. He was a fired police officer from another department who his law firm was the same law firm that represents our police department.
And had created the playbook.
And created the playbook. Dieter Dan Meyer Law Firm created the playbook. And he worked for the law firm. He was on the website. His face was on there. I mean, and they always hired ex-cops to be who were lawyers or ex-cops to be investigators. And so basically it was the union had set it up. And I knew that had happened. I knew that was going on. The following day, I did a press conference. And I'd always been good with the press because I was very upfront about it. So they believed me, but they're like, you know, really? And I said, yeah. And I remember when I was going to the press conference, the pile of change on my dresser had the wadded up receipt. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I took it and I just stuck it in my pocket.
Which receipt is this?
The Diet Coke.
The Diet Cokes.
So remember, we're in a world of press now where nobody's got any money or any budgets.
Right.
They're not going to go search for it and go check out computers and go to the restaurant to see what I actually bought. Mm-hmm. But I happen to have it with me. And so the one reporter just said, hey, can we have that for 1 second? They put it up on a piece of white paper. Everybody, you know, viewed it. And Righeimer said he's been set up. Councilman Righeimer's been set up. It's just a union. And then literally, then it goes public that, yes, it was a union, the law firm's employee who was following me. He did a setup for a DUI. Following that.
And the woman, not to leave the rifle just sitting on the wall in the first act of the play, nothing transpires with the woman. I mean, she just edges, as I remember the story in the press, she kind of edged close to you and tried.
No, it wasn't me. It was Gary Monahan.
Oh,
the other
city
guy.
The bar owner.
No, and here's the other thing is they're texting the people in the bar who are paid for by the union, the fired police. There are two fired police officers, by the way. There was another one in the restaurant and this other police officer. One of them has since died. The other one did go to, you know, jail when they finally convicted him. But no, she's texting, hey, I got this guy on the hook. He's easy. Basically, you know, saying to Gary. And Gary's just a bar restaurant owner being nice to a guest.
Yeah.
I mean, but what was interesting is they had their code, their special coded, you know, security for their texting, and the DA's office cracked the code and got all their texts. So while they're saying things to us at the same exact time, they're texting to the law firm, please, boss, just give me 2 weeks. I'll be gone. I won't say anything about you. You don't say anything about me. I mean, stuff like that. Mm-hmm, it was pretty bad. But then later on, the district attorney, the time
Tony Rakakis
just said, He knew it was a big enough case. He says, we cannot have a situation where residents go to bed at night not knowing that their city councilman might have voted on something so they wouldn't be blackmailed. That's just wrong. He went after it. As they dug into it, they got the computers from the labor unions and from the law firm. And in they had information, and they went to the other council member, Steve Menzinger, and they said to him, we have to have a meeting, and can you bring your date book for last year? So he brings it, and they say, on December 22nd, you were here. And he goes, yes. And on January, whatever, you were here. And he goes, yes. But they ask, like, for my places. And then they said, did you give anybody permission to put a tracking device on your car?
Mm.
He said, no. They said, well, you've had a tracking device on your car all along. Now, they never got the tracking device, but they got all the data on the computer showing the tracking device literally going to one of the police officers, you know, the fired police officer's house because he was changing the batteries.
Wow.
Because they'd have to go out there. Anyways, that's kind of the case. It blew up and went in the court. Like I said, one of the fired police officers died of natural causes before it went to trial, and the other one finally just pled guilty, and they gave him a year in jail.
A year for blackmailing a public official.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It got down to the point where so what happens, this is one of the biggest things that we found out with labor unions and the whole problem that happened with George Floyd and all these other issues. It's impossible to fire a police officer. Now, again, I come from a family of law enforcement, and I want to support police officers any way I can, men or women. But it's impossible to fire them. When you read the contracts, you know, the contract may be, you know, 40 pages long. 20 of it is about disciplinary things and what you can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. And mostly in California, in most of the contracts, it'll basically say that if the officer does something wrong and his superior wants to talk to them about something that could affect their employment or their standing in their job or could somehow be a penalty to them, they have to stop immediately. Say to them that that's what's about to happen. Allow the officer to get a lawyer, and They have time, literally, with the lawyers to coordinate between everybody else, mm-hmm. all the other police mm-hmm. officers.
Yeah, there's a kind of a cooling off period,
right?
Or 48 hours,
right?
Or,
and they have that amount of time, and they're not required to give anything or say anything or do anything.
It's treated like a criminal investigation rather than an employment problem.
Yeah, except that you don't. I mean, a criminal is going to have a crime for destroying evidence and those kind of things. I can't get into the technical of why it is, but they have a lot more protections.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you get a bad cop, like in the George Floyd case, who obviously should have been gone. Hey, how many times you have to have
17?
Yeah, ridiculous cases against us.
Abuse of force,
and you just can't get rid of them, and so you're stuck with them. So that's where I would always go back and look back at the unions and say, hey, I'm supporting you guys. I'm 1,000% behind you. But when you don't let us fire the bad ones, this is crazy. And that, by the way, hasn't changed.
Right.
That's the same as it is today.
Yeah. So in the end, the court found in your favor.
Right.
You guys won a substantial award, but not substantial.
Well, we won everything all the way through, and then they finally rolled. They just, you know.
They settled.
They settled, yeah, at the
okay.
end.
And I think the number is out there about how much the settlement was for.
It was like $600,000-$700,000.
Right.
I mean, lawyers
ate up most of
yeah,
it, sure.
Yeah, you're not going to.
No. But it's nothing like what you would find in a civil case where somebody is shot while fighting with cops and
they get $20 million.
They get $20 million, right.
Yeah.
So, this is your. Your whole experience, and we haven't even, we've just scratched the surface of it, but your experience on the city council in Costa Mesa was really key to forming my sense of the problem with government unions. That is that kind of legalized corruption. I mean, you just talked about the illegal kind of corruption,
right.
But there's also just the legal corruption of running. You raise money for membership dues. You use that to finance the campaigns of public officials or political candidates. And then once they're in office, you lobby the hell out of them. And, we see this all over the state, that these same unions will come back to a person and say, basically, you don't vote right on this one. Take you out.
The one part that I didn't make clear on it in there is one of the things that what they did is I say if you want to lose a needle in the haystack, the first thing you got to do is just make the haystack.
Mm.
And so what the labor union came back with was every member of our association is liable, and we want to make sure that they all get immunity mm-hmm. from prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Every member.
Hmm.
Before we talk, because the DA couldn't get anybody to talk about anything. I mean, the code of silence was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, every member of the department got immunity, and then the head of the union talked. But the problems that were happening was they tripled the dues to pay for this private investigator. And when they said, what's that for? Regular members said, what's that for? Ah, don't worry about it. You know, we got a political thing going on here. You don't understand. And this kind of gets back to the bunch of 30-year-olds running the place.
Mm-hmm.
You get a 35-year-old, high testosterone, A personality, which is exactly the kind of person you want to be a police officer, quite frankly. I mean, you do.
Yeah.
You want good, solid people
That's
out
right.
there. But then all of a sudden, you're on their bad side. They're the head of the union, and they want to be righteous.
They don't think clearly at that
They
age.
Don't think clearly yeah. at 35 years of age. And there's no 60-year-old guy there going, what the heck are you doing?
Yeah, counseling wisdom.
Because they've all retired.
Right, right. Hey, I want to get to the stories that you and I have been discussing here for the show. But before I do that, I just want to say a couple of things. Like, number one, this is the end of the year time. California Policy Center could sure use your help. That's the organization I work with. If you go to californiapolicycenter.org, you see the donate button there at the top of the homepage, and click on that. You can make even a modest contribution to CPC. Really helps, and it helps you with your taxes, but it also helps just save California. And also, I want to encourage everybody to go to nationalreview.com/plus. That's NR Plus. That's the National Review's digital magazine. There's no paywall, all the issues in a 10-year archive and all the podcasts, but it's more than a digital subscription. It's a membership that includes access to the members-only Facebook page, members-only conference calls with NR writers, editors, and guests, and members-only commenting on the site, and a lot fewer ads, including none within the articles. It's really a great deal. So again, go to nationalreview.com/plus. That's P-L-U-S, not the plus sign. And you can read everything about the membership offer there. Okay, so Jim, I wanted to start off by saying that what we're really going to talk about here is the I've mentioned this in the podcast throughout the last year, that California is really a national and even international menace to civilization. And before I get to that point, I want to illustrate what's going on in California now by referencing the movie Dirty Harry. Those of us of a certain age remember Clint Eastwood's standout performance. It was apparently supposed to go to a bunch of other people, including Frank Sinatra, who I cannot imagine being Dirty Harry. You can only imagine Clint Eastwood
in
this role,
right.
I think. But this came out 50 years ago this week, and the movie features a San Francisco cop played by Clint Eastwood, Harry Callahan, and he was originally supposed to be a New York Police Department cop, but they eventually settled on San Francisco as their setting for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the number one, the city with the highest crime rate in America in 1969 when the film was being developed was San Francisco. You've got Haight-Ashbury. We've talked about all the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont in this on this show. You've got, I mean, just the drug culture exploding. You've got kids coming from all, homeless kids, really, coming
right,
from all
right.
over the country to
settle. Flower power, all the hippies.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Different cultures, yeah.
Yeah, Alcatraz. This is way back in my youth. I think I was 9 when a Native American group occupies Alcatraz, you might remember, saying that this is, you know, some sort of kind of a sacred ground and they want it back, and they raise the tribal warfare flag. This stuff was going on all over San Francisco. And so, as a listener told me, who shall remain nameless, this movie comes out in the context of real crime going off
right.
the charts in San Francisco.
And the frustration of a lot of the people who were from the 50s and the 60s, that everything was kind of more of happy days.
That's right.
And now you've got people along here, and they're fighting police and all the things that we were, you know, that people are taught not to do. So there was a whole cultural thing of, we all have to be nicer and friendlier and more open, but we're not really comfortable with the way it's going.
That's right. And in the movie, of course, Harry is flouting all kinds of, you know, he's a cop, and
right.
he's flouting all kinds of department procedure. And famously, hey, if you haven't seen the movie, I'm so sorry, but it's, well, you know, a lot of our listeners are younger than you and I, so I guess I won't, I won't describe the ending, except to say that it is a classic of cinema that has landed the film on top 100 lists and really shows the contempt which a lot of middle America, including people in San Francisco, had for handcuffing cops in pursuit of really dangerous criminals.
And 50 years later?
We have the same thing.
Exactly.
And that's, I think, part. But what happens next in San Francisco is the pendulum swings a bit.
Right.
And for a brief period of time, a brief shining moment in San Francisco, just as we saw in New York City when Rudy Giuliani becomes mayor and really kind of cleans up that town, you know, people can only take so much before the pendulum swings the other way and you start to get some common sense. On this show, we've talked about London Breed, the famously progressive mayor of San Francisco, who has kind of flouted the mask mandate, but not really done anything to speak out against it. She just flouted it for her own personal convenience.
Right.
But in all honesty, she's started to really find herself in a conflict with the DA, Chesa Bodine, I always struggle to pronounce his name, who is a famously progressive, left-wing, radical, soft-on-crime kind of DA. So here's London Breed at war with her own DA over the problem of crime, saying, you've got to step in and start prosecuting these crimes. She's supported the recall of the San Francisco School Board for famously shutting down the schools in the city, which affects disproportionately black kids in that
right.
city, because all the rich people who love public education put their kids in private schools. So you've got this kind of moment where I think even progressives in San Francisco are starting to wake up, very Dirty Harry style. We saw these smash and grab raids. We've seen riots in the city. The homeless problem's out of control. People are fleeing the city.
People have had it. And I talk to people up there and they talk about how all these progressive things came in and were supported, quote unquote, by everybody. And they're like, and now all those college students have left and gone off to wherever they're going to school now or their job. And they left us with these laws that got passed that make no sense whatsoever. And some of these laws that got passed were initiatives. So it means it would take a vote of the people to put these into effect. It takes a vote of the people to change them.
That's right.
You know, you can't put people in jail if it's, you know, under $950.
Right.
I mean, all these just crazy ideas. And so There's less and less control you have. I mean, the drug problem has gotten out of hand. One of the best levers we always had was forcing people to go into drug rehab.
Yeah.
You want to go to jail? We want to go to drug rehab. We don't want to fill up our jails with a bunch of people on drugs. That's not the idea. The idea is you want to clean them up, right?
Mm-hmm.
The best you can. But sometimes you need to have the stick, which is you're going to jail. Now, there's no stick.
Well, this is a great segue into our list of ways in which California has become a menace to society. And I'm going to jump down to number six on the list there, Jim.
Yeah.
And that's Javier Becerra.
Javier, the man.
Yeah. He goes from being the Attorney General of California to Joe Biden's Director of Health and Human Services. And we talked about this in the show, so a lot of this is reprised today. I hope you will accept this, dear listener, under a different kind of package. But Javier goes to D.C. and says, you know what we really need nationwide is we need San Francisco's drug policies.
Yep.
These failed drug policies that have wrecked San Francisco are now embedded in things like the Build Back Better initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got this, you know, being promulgated as legitimate reaction to drug abuse and drug trafficking and addiction problems that are really, truly serious, as if San Francisco wasn't a counterexample for the failure of these things. I'll put a couple of stories in the show notes, but Michael Schellenberger, the former lefty like myself, has wonderfully documented this stuff in his work. My favorite story there remains this year's piece in which he said, look, more African Americans have died in San Francisco from drug overdose in San Francisco than died from the entire Tuskegee experiment, which lasted, 50 years. So, you know, this is a crime against a population which already had some skepticism about government intervention. And if you
right.
want to look at the dangers of government non-intervention or dangerous intervention, here it is in San Francisco, now metastasizing and going national.
And you wonder why they won't get a shot.
Yeah, no kidding. Right.
Yeah, I think I'll pass on the shot.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder why.
And speaking of other public officials whom we have sent to Washington, of course, there's the infamous Kamala Harris. We could go on all day about this. David and I talk about it every week, I think, in our Kamala Corner, as we sometimes call it.
You mean her first interview for her first job with Willie?
You want to talk about that?
You know what? I hate to say it because I'm in the workplace nowadays, you really got to be concerned about how women are treated. You should be. I've got three sisters. I got three daughters. I mean, I really care about this. But, you know, Willie Brown was, you know, the most powerful man in California. She's 29. He's 61. She's dating him.
Yeah.
You know, now, again, do I know how it happened? Do I know there's pressure on her? I don't know. I don't know anything. It's just not a good start off. And then what does he do? He gives her these plum assignments, these jobs.
I think she
jobs.
Was appointed to the Parking Commission, if I remember correctly.
She was on one of the medical. So there's different state boards that pay the same as a senator makes.
Mm.
So at the time, it was probably $90,000, $100,000 a year. But it's literally one meeting a month for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it is. And he put her on one of the boards, and she made her $100,000 a year. And then she didn't like that board, and he switched her to another board. But he's the most powerful man around, and you know he's a married man, and you're dating him. It's just problematic,
yeah.
You know, to say the least. And so what you find with Kamala, forgetting that, the rest of her whole career is just like this big, a CV. I mean, it's just her bio. It's a bio thing is all it is. You know, black woman. Of course, she was black then.
Mm.
She didn't become Asian until later.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
when that became an issue.
When that became more important to become Asian. And so she's always kind of jumped from job to job to job, kind of in the political world. And the other thing that we have in California is that we're so one-sided to the Democrat side that everything gets kind of screwed up. So you have no balance whatsoever. So things like who's going to run for office, who's going to run for DA, who's going to run for attorney general, who's going to run for these different positions are literally done at the central committee level,
mm-hmm.
which is, it sounds like the central committee is like the Soviet Union.
The Politburo, yes.
The Politburo. Yeah. I mean, that's literally what it is because it doesn't actually happen out in the open because there's no one for them to fight. So it's just the power brokers that kind of figure it all
right.
out and whose turn it is.
And they don't have to think about who's going to be the best person to compete with a Republican for this office.
Exactly.
Never.
And so all they have to do
is a resume.
And they go ahead and they clear the primary and it's over.
Right.
And that person gets in, whether they have the ability to do it or not. Now, remember, the big thing for Democrats to get in office, especially attorney generals, you just had to be tough on crime.
yeah.
be tough on crime. So she has a perfect pitch. I'm a woman of color. They didn't call woman of color back then. She no. says, you know, I was an African-American
right.
woman. And but you know what? Throw away the key.
Mm-hmm.
These people have to go to prison
That's
forever
right.
and all that. She would laugh about people that had, you know, literally had the marijuana convictions
right.
that were kind of BS,
mm-hmm.
that were in prison for 10 years. And she's like, tough.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, she's just running on this resume constantly. We get all the way down to, you talk about power brokers. I mean, we're in a situation that the person of the President of the United States right now, Joe Biden, didn't have a chance. It was over until the party power brokers just said, oh, my God, we only have the nuts and the kooks left.
Right.
And at the 11th hour, three major candidates, Buttigieg, the senator from Minnesota, whatever, all drop out. They get that with the South, was it the South Carolina primary with
I think you're right, yeah.
Clay, am I saying his name wrong, the congressman, but basically supported Biden. In one weekend, it all flipped, and Biden was going to be the next president
right.
of the United States. He was going to be their person. And, oh, by the way, we got to check off some boxes. Kamala Harris, who you know dropped out of the race before anybody else, is now the best qualified to be
yeah.
vice president of the United States.
Not Tulsi Gabbard, interestingly.
Yeah, yeah, not Tulsi. And, again, this is one of the things that I've noticed being involved in this for a long time, that the people that really kind of get it, they can be on the left or on the right, and as long as we're continuing to talk, we're going to move forward.
That's right.
You got to have people on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And all my friends on the right, oh, no. I said, no, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You need creatives. You need people that have great ideas. You need people that are outside the box. You need to talk. And they need to talk to the more conservatives that are like, hey, let's not all go crazy tomorrow. Tulsi Gabbard was a perfect one for
yes.
that. She was in the military. She had done a lot of things. And she was lefty on some major things that I was against, but
right.
she was so true and honest. It was like, I like this lady.
Yes, yes. Well, it's what you've just described is a character trait on your part that partly accounts for why I'm here today, why I'm where I have arrived, you know, politically and philosophically, because you and I were friends. We did TV together
yeah.
Long before
you
my
were,
conversion.
You were the liberal.
Right.
I was the conservative.
That's right.
Except when you would go up and do PBS up in L.A.
with Hugh Hewitt, right?
Hugh Hewitt, and they would just say, oh, you're from Orange County, you're the conservative.
You're the conservative.
And you could just be like, oh, I got to be conservative now, watch this, boom,
yeah.
and you just, you know, cover it.
True dat. Okay, so that's those guys. Let's talk about a couple of other issues. We just described this a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it was even just the last episode. David and I talked about fraud, which is number one on my hit list here at the Employment
Oh, yeah.
Development Division. Our listeners will recall that the U.S. Attorney General carrying out this investigation into the fraud has determined that the, you know, a number which was variously pegged at somewhere between 10 and 31 billion is at least now 20 billion. And that the beneficiaries.
And do the listeners know what we're talking about here?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and describe.
So basically, you know, we're going into the pandemic. We need to get money out. We're trying to figure out how to do it. The simplest way to do it. Government's trying to do it. And there's something to be said for, hey, let's just get it out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's also something to say, let's have some basic controls, or let's as we're funneling the money out, let's check it out. In California, they it looks like, and you're hearing from the DOJ, is at least $20 billion was just emailed out or given to cards out or electronically transferred to felons, criminals, international organizations. There was no, all you had to do was fill out forms, whatever. They had the stuff filled out by computers as fast as they could generate this stuff. The money comes flying in. And now, how do you pay for it?
That's right.
So how do you
pay back on the fraud?
You pay back on the fraud, right?
So
normally it'd be like the state would come in or they'd sue somebody. No. They're going to go to all the employers and just say, oh, you know, basically the EDD is for employment development is when you get laid off.
Right.
You know, unemployment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they're basically saying, oh, there's an additional $20 billion in unemployment, and so all the employers have to pay for it now is basically what they're going to do.
Yes. So just to be clear here, under the general heading of today's conversation, California's a menace to society, is this fraud was carried out, according to the Department of Justice, primarily to the benefit of transnational organized crime groups and domestic organized crime groups. That's our gift to the rest of the United States, is we have helped fund operations for some really dangerous people.
Yeah, so whenever it is a way to give money away free, they don't even look at who they're giving away at, and then they don't take any responsibility.
None.
They just dump it on all the employers. A little aside here, a funny one the other day, talking to one of the young guys that works for me. When he got his vaccination, it was a time when they were giving out the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he got a $50 gift certificate.
Oh, that's
to go
right.
to do it. He goes to cash the gift certificate. It had already been cashed.
Oh, my gosh.
So even the gift certificates they're giving out, this is anecdotal, but he says, and I said, what'd you do? He says, what am I going to do? $50? I'm going to fight about it? It was already been cashed.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about the supply chain crisis. Almost everybody in the world knows that right now the cost of goods is going up, the price of goods is going up because we're not able to get the full supply of products out into the marketplace for a whole host of reasons we're going to talk about in a second. The result is inflation, right? That's what we're starting to see now because there's more dollars, some of it pushed out by the federal government, chasing fewer products. And part of the supply chain grid is right here, visible off the coast of Orange County. You've seen it. I've seen it. You walk out here to Corona del Mar, you look toward Catalina, and there's 100 or so ships in a gigantic parking lot out there in little serried ranks, which you can see.
Yeah, so Long Beach Harbor and L.A. Harbor have 40% of all harbor shipments, all boat shipments that come through those two places. And why are they all screwed up?
Yes. Well, they're screwed up because California runs them.
Right.
California.
And there's a bunch of different reasons. And when you talk to people about the reasons, especially the ones that have to work with everybody in Sacramento, they just bite their tongue.
Yes.
Because they don't want to upset people. So first off, one of the first things you have is the ports are all clogged. Well, let's go ahead and let's get these guys working, 7 days a week, right? Oh, no. They don't work 7 days a week.
This is the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union.
Right. But there's other groups, too.
Sure.
So there's different groups. And then there's the people that actually run the terminals. And then you talk to the people that run the terminals, off to the side. And it's like, oh, well, we want to be open. But if we go and say we'll be open, then the union will be pissed at us, even though we don't employ these people.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll never get stuff. Or, how about they just send that ship away or they just unload it? I mean, the penalty and the payment that you can do to people when you have California-style control.
Yes.
I mean, the labor unions, we've all known it. I mean, everybody knows it. Have such control on that harbor that they just basically,
well, this ILWU,
feather bedding beyond what you can imagine.
Yeah, this ILWU is so corrupt. In 2020, I want to say it is, a judge found them liable for almost $100 million for direct results of their corruption in that area. As you say, no port authority, no port official will ever condemn these guys, especially on the eve of contract negotiations. 2022 is a time for the renewal of their contract, and the union's already banking loads of cash for member dues so they can put out a strike fund.
Terminal operators have fired their own employees because their own employees were getting in there saying, hey, this is wrong. They shouldn't do that.
Right.
They're like, you don't understand. We can't fight it.
That's right.
We need to get the ships unloaded.
That's right.
We don't want to fight it.
And then we've got all the crazy, zany environmental laws around trucks, especially. You've got Assembly Bill 5, which is targeted right at independent truckers to the benefit of large trucking companies. That are unionized.
If they're
not
unionized, doesn't count.
That's right.
So you need all these people to go out there with their chassis, whatever, and pick up all this cargo, right? Thousands and thousands of trucks. And we have tons of independent truck drivers.
That's right. Ready to go to work. But
Can't do it.
Instead, the answer out of Sacramento is maybe let's reduce the age at which truckers can truck to 16. That's one answer, which seems inconceivable to me. I was 16 once, and I know how I drove.
I think we should try 18 before 16, maybe.
That would be nice.
Because they're at 21.
Yeah. So you've got that. You've got a new executive regulation that just came out in which the state is going to require trucks to be monitored for their emissions in such a way that would allow the state is going to build these kinds of freeway side pollution emission control centers where it's almost like a smog control center. You're going to pull off the road with your truck. You'll have a transponder. Your emissions will be checked. And if you don't pass, you're out. You do not get to drive that truck in California. So anybody who's driving a truck that is up to the standards of every other state in the union has to drive in here and face separate emission standards in California just because we get to have clean air only. So there are various, I think we call this in supply chain logistics, we call these friction points.
Right.
And California's aren't just friction points, they're like walls or barriers.
Well, it's not just that. Remember that if you're an independent driver, there's money out there. The harbors have money to go ahead and change your fleet to the new diesels that are cleaner. You cannot get the, in the end, you can't get the financing unless you're labor.
That's
your labor union. If you're not, unionized, so the independent can't get that to go ahead and replace the truck or replace the engine. Can't do that. So again, it's all kind of set up in this game. And if you've been in California for a long time, that's just the rules of the game. That's just how it's done. And when you talk about how things affect, you know, across the country, you know, shipping, you can't get things out.
Right.
I mean, we're paying, think about it, we're paying more for stuff, and there really isn't a reason. So then think about who's making all the money.
Yeah.
I mean, the shipping companies are like, are you kidding me? I saw the numbers the other day. Shipping companies for the last 20 years have been kind of like a break even, make a few bucks a world.
Mm-hmm.
Break even, make a few bucks. That's all they were.
Yep.
They're going from like, you know, $1 billion in net revenues to like $20 billion in net revenues. I may have those numbers wrong, but that's the magnitudes that we're talking about. You think they're complaining about it?
No.
Everything good here.
That's right.
Everything good.
But what is starting to happen is we're seeing ships bound for L.A. deciding they're going to go Panama Canal into the Gulf ports, into the East Coast ports. California's ports, specifically L.A. and Long Beach, are the least efficient of major ports in the world and in the U.S. New York, New Jersey, far better. Seattle, Tacoma, far better.
Well, they still do things on paper.
Yes.
They literally handwrite stuff with the rest of the world's barcoding.
That's right. And this was all built into the Build Back Better Biden initiative, which looks like it's been scuttled, thank God. But it was built into this bill that we were going to allow only those kinds of technical innovations, modernization programs in terms of technology. We're only going to allow those to the extent that they still remained human managed.
Correct.
You could not displace labor. So there's no labor saving allowed in the port of L.A., one of the worst ports in the world.
But you're against good jobs. What's wrong with you, Will?
I'm a sick,
these
sick
are
man.
These are just good jobs. Everybody should have. My favorite was when we would complain about the pensions that the public employees had, the unions would come back to us and say, everybody should have that pension.
That's right. That's right.
I'm like, can anybody do any math around here?
No, the answer is no. No math. And related to this shipping problem, the supply chain problem, is the we've talked about this in the show as well. I'll put the story that I wrote on it in the show notes. But the coming bacon apocalypse. This is related to California's Proposition 12 in 2018. California voters voted to make it was under the auspices of a kind of a PETA, you know, a People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals sort of initiative. It was we need to reduce animal cruelty to an absolute minimum. Hey, nobody's for animal cruelty.
Right.
But the implication was that somehow this was making, cages larger or performing, I don't know, putting pants on animals and little shoes or something, whatever it is. I mean, in fairness, it was like, you know, animals ought to be able to turn around in these cages or whatever.
Chickens
especially.
Turn around.
Yeah. But you have pigs, cows, you know, beef cattle. And all of this stuff was designed to make Californians feel better about the meat they consume. But because we are such a large state, the impact on meat producers worldwide, and specifically in the Midwest, in the U.S., in the Southeast, the impact on them was inevitable. And so many of these companies are unable to produce for the California market a kind of a separate boutique product. So they're trying to figure out how quickly they can race to meet California standard for the whole state, for the whole country. This, of course, was California's intention. We're going to be the city on the hill, a shining beacon to all other countries and states. In fact, what looks likely to happen is that people will fail to meet the mandate. They will be heavily fined by California. It will create yet another supply chain crisis in meat products. Who will this hurt the most? Jim, is it going to hurt you and me? You know, you and I will pay a few extra bucks every week for meat. But for somebody who's on a fixed income or a single parent trying to raise kids, working class people.
Just listen, it's not even poor people or just working class. The amount of money is getting crazy. I took my young daughter out to one of the local, you know, sandwich shops, you know, a chain that you know out there, and we got the giant sandwich. It's just the bigger sandwich, and they call it the giant, but it just had provolone and whatever on it. It was $17.
Oh my gosh.
It was $17. You get that in a Diet Coke, you're at $20.
Yeah.
That kind of money, families just don't have it to just go ahead and say, "Hey, everybody go get a sandwich," and it's in, you know, there's five of you, three kids and a mom and dad. Now, the kids don't eat that much, but again, $75 to go out and get some food. That people don't have that kind of money, but to come from is, "Hey, don't worry about it. It'll somehow get worked out."
Right.
You know, I always when you look at an area like with housing costs, any area that doesn't have enough housing because of all the restraints they have on building housing, and people may want to live there, like Southern California. People just want to live here.
Mm-hmm.
We have the 1% of the 1% of the 1% that want to live in California. No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Southern California. Look how nice it is, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll go ahead and they'll raise it. So what do you think happens when they go from $10 an hour to $15 an hour? The money all ends up going to the landlord, period.
Mm-hmm.
Because people will pay whatever it costs them to be there. And if there's not enough housing, they'll pay more. And if they got two in an apartment or three, it doesn't really matter. Whatever the number is. And I'm not saying it's overcrowded. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying people will spend.
Yes.
So if you go ahead and raise wages in an area that has a total restriction on housing, it just
goes up. Cost of housing is going to go up.
It just goes up. It's all because there's no more that's built or made. And then what does the government come in and do? In like California, we got rid of R1.
Tell me about that.
In California,
residential.
Okay, so basically a normal neighborhood, a 5,000 square foot, 6,000 square foot lot with a single family house in California is no more. California passed a law right after the governor.
This is Senate Bill 9.
Yeah, right after the governor got through his recall, passed a law that said every backyard in an R1 neighborhood can put two apartments. Now, for the left or people that don't understand it, just, well, we need more housing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're creating a bunch more houses, but they don't have to park them.
Right.
So when I was on the council and they wanted to
And when you say don't have to park them, supply space for parking.
Space for parking on the lot. So when I was on the council and they wanted to do quote unquote a granny flat, which is just an apartment. There's no granny in sight. But you do it, we'd say, hey, but you have to have a parking space on site because you would impact the community, which is the street, right?
Right.
People only have so many parking spaces in front of their house. Now can you imagine that same neighborhood? Everywhere in California, this is not like for new construction, but this is every area, you can put an apartment in your backyard or two with no worry about parking if you're within a certain distance of a bus line, basically, which most urban areas are. And so we've gone ahead and we've passed that. Now, what happens in the end? Is there more housing? Yeah, there's more housing. Will it bring rents down? Marginally in the beginning, not in those units because they're brand new.
Right.
So, you know, there'll be some competition. But once they get filled up, the prices will go back up again.
Mm-hmm.
But what does it do to home ownership?
Mm-hmm.
Wipes it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are no longer homes. That's a house with two units behind it. Who buys that? An investor.
Mm.
When you're going to buy in that same neighborhood, and I know, you know, these numbers sound crazy, but they're like $700,000 for a house in a neighborhood of a, you know, 50, 60-year house in Orange County that's not, you know, it's in so-so shape and all that is what you pay. Now that's going to sell for $1.1 million, $1.2 million. Homeowners can't buy that.
Right.
Investors
okay, so
buy that.
Play this game for me. Is there any way to tie this into the theme of today's show? You're a housing expert. I mean, this is your business. And what's the national impact, if any? I mean, I can't imagine what it is.
There's an impact on it that, they do it in California and it's working just fine.
It's sort of
So it just becomes part of the conversation.
Got it.
That it's okay. My favorite one was all the stuff in California. You'd want to build an apartment building. And they'd come and they'd say, hey, we want to have a bunch of shops and stores on the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds great
Mixed
in downtown
use.
San Francisco. That sounds great in New York where there's a subway and an elevator above you. But you know, in a suburban area, that's just called vacant space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody wants, you know, I want a Starbucks and a sandwich shop and a nail place under my building.
Mm-hmm.
There's only 48 tenants there. They're not going to, you know, keep these businesses going because there's not enough density for that.
So you do a lot of work outside the state. Maybe do you see examples of where California's kind of, I'll call it moral authority, or maybe its dark shadow looms over the housing landscape in a place like Colorado, just as an example?
Well, I mean, clearly, you know, you got no fracking in California. Fracking is being shut down in Colorado in all sorts of different ways. And fracking, you know, probably the worst word they could have ever made for, call it that, because it just sounds bad. You know,
I
don't want any fracking.
Yeah.
And it's just oil drilling horizontally underground, and it has a less of a footprint. You know, you don't have to have wells all over the place. You know, it can be handled quite well. But so you're seeing it that there's just different rules that shut down housing. So we'll say, hey, instead of you having to be 500 feet from an abandoned, sealed up, closed down well, could have been a dry hole, didn't even have oil. You have to have the houses 500 feet away. Well, now let's have them 1,000 feet away. Let's have them 2,000 feet away. Well, 2,000 feet away is a circumference of like almost a mile.
Yeah.
Right? So a mile area which can't build any houses.
Right.
Do you think that's going to bring up costs?
Yeah, I think it might.
Because what happens, it's not just the houses and that you build. It's the infrastructure to get to it. It's the road. It's the sewer pipe. It's the water pipe. It's the electricity. It's everything else you have to do to build that neighborhood. You just made that stuff undevelopable. The whole thing, because you're within so many feet of it.
So let's, as long as we're talking about fracking, let's talk about just really quickly, because I want to blast through the rest of these things here before Brian has to run away. Thanks for staying here, Brian. So California's climate change initiatives, its environmental policies really do, in terms of like fracking, as you've pointed out, they really do have, they impose burdens on other people, and not just sort of the moral authority which California can claim when another state says, hey, California did it, but I'm talking about a direct impact. So California has banned, by executive authority, Governor Newsom pulled a total Obama here with regard to the Dreamers sort of thing, but Newsom did it on fracking and said that, hey, you know, I would, if I could, I would use executive authority to ban fracking, but I don't have that constitutional authority. Then he turned around and banned it through an executive order by 2024. We have killed all of our nuclear. San Onofre is already being dismantled. Diablo Canyon up north is being shut down slowly.
Which I understand, nuclear is carbon free.
It is.
Last I checked.
Yeah, weird thing, huh?
Yeah.
And these, you know, I
what does France have, like 80 of them? 80 nuclear?
Oh my gosh, buddy.
Like 80, 90? That's why they're, yeah, by the way, the Paris Climate Accords and all that, they're good.
Yeah.
They have all nuclear.
They do. And Germany is hugely into nuclear.
Right.
Yes. So what happens when California does things like, now there's this initiative we've talked about on the show. There was this recent oil spill off the coast of Huntington Beach.
Right.
You might remember when a ship that was stuck in this traffic congested port that we've already described, drags its anchor in a storm across one of the pipelines. And the state of California has two responses to this. Number one, let's sue the people who own the pipeline, whose fault this was not, by the way.
Right.
Let's blame the ship that was stalled out and kept out of the port for an unsupportable amount of time, and which, in a storm, dragged its anchor across this pipeline. They were ordered, the ship was, to park in that space by a government authority.
Those ships we used to never see in Huntington Beach or Newport Beach. They were off Huntington Beach and Newport Beach. I mean, you just look out the window and you see ships lined up.
That's right.
Waiting to get into port for 2-3 weeks at a time.
So the oil spill happens, and now there's a move in California and federally to shut down all offshore oil drilling. So we've got no fracking on land, no oil drilling offshore. And we've got California constantly at war with automakers trying to impose vehicle emission standards that really, again, tail wags dog. This is California telling these automakers, you have to make a special car for California or just produce one that meets our standards for everybody in the country.
Which it goes back to your pork issue. Basically, they were the first. The auto industry was the first where they just said, fine, we'll do a California standard.
Yeah.
Then when Trump came in, Trump said, no. States, you can do whatever you want to do. You don't have to follow California. You can follow the federal standards. And they did that. Of course, what did the big auto manufacturers say? Oh, no. Put the rules back on us again because we have to make California happy. And
that's
Trump
right.
says you don't have to make California happy. You have to make the federal government happy.
Yeah.
Big business has no problem with, you know, having government control what they do if it helps them.
That's right. Well, we've talked about this on the show. One of my favorite books in grad school was Gabriel Kolko's The Triumph of Conservatism, a Marxist analysis of how government regulation works under capitalism. It's an anti-capitalist screed, but its point is one that conservatives would appreciate. It's about regulatory capture. So California is regulatory capture writ large everywhere. It is the incumbent players, the government unions, the big businesses, the social media giants who have said, we'll go along with all the zany. Just let us keep making our money. And also, please, build a wall around our industry so no competitors can come in and undermine us and throw us off our horse. California's lack, and I have talked about this, I have flogged this horse so much that we'll just move quickly through it, but California has so, I'm moving on to the issue of how California's forest management is so disastrous. And not just California, I want to be fair, this is also federal management imposed by federal regulators in the Environmental Protection Agency, but between the federal government's mismanagement and the state's mismanagement of government-owned forests, we have wildfires here now with such regularity that we can really count on the whole swaths of the state being burned down. And it'd be one thing if our idiocy was imposed only on us and our citizens who are poor enough to be stuck in these places where their homes burn down, they lose everything, and are sometimes killed. I mean, these are murderous fires, if I could anthropomorphize a moment. They're killer fires. And we have loads of evidence now that our fires, our wildfires, impose a climate disaster on people outside of California. I'll pop one story into the show notes, but the bottom line is you can track this last summer and the summer before, you can track how asthma attacks, how people's upper respiratory illness has risen out in Colorado. I think we were talking
about. I'm telling you, you're hours away by plane from the fires. And if you're in the Denver area or just the North Front Range, you're looking out, you don't see the sunset.
Yeah.
You don't see the sunset. The smoke is so bad from the fires that we had. But again, what are they trying to do? It's not so forest management is one way to call it. What is forest management? Forest management is taking down trees.
Right.
That's a lumber industry. That's people that cut down trees. The environmentalists hate people that cut down trees. They don't want to help it. They'd rather have that industry just die off and figure out some way to build houses without trees. So they don't allow anybody to do it. So that's kind of the fault that they go to, is like, just don't have anybody cut down trees. Mm. What do you think they're doing when they're doing forest management?
Right.
You're spreading things out. Sure, they're getting the low brush out and all that kind of stuff, but basically it's going ahead and taking down trees, and they're against that.
And
even though trees,
this,
by the way, are a very renewable resource.
Is that right? You can grow them again?
In fact, if you fly over the northwest of this country where you see the trees, you can see the whole squares where they cut all the trees out, and then you see the new ones growing behind it, then the one next to it that's 10 years later.
Right.
It's amazing how fast these trees grow.
Environmentalists do not like this.
No.
Man should have a very light footprint, if any footprint at all. Okay, so let's talk about number 7 on my list, Jim. That's the pension crisis. Again, I think that the small issue here that you and I already talked about this a little bit with your experience as mayor of Costa Mesa and how you were trying to get a handle on a pension cost that to your city was starting to really make you make difficult choices. Do I raise taxes in order to pay for these rising pension obligations, or do I just cut government services?
Well, you look at cities, especially ones that are run by the left out there, and LA is a great example of it. You go in neighborhoods that they haven't poured a yard of concrete for 25 years. So you can go on a long time without going bankrupt. You just don't pay for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't pay for any infrastructure. You don't pay for any new roads, for any new curb and gutter, for any sidewalks that are busted up. You just don't do anything, and you can get along because what? You're spending so many dollars on, first of all, the unions get these pensions approved. Then you have a double whammy when the federal government starts handing out money left and right, printing money at the Federal Reserve. That interest rates drop down to what? A 10-year note is a 1.5%? How does a pension fund? Pension funds used to take their money and invest it. So a good, solid pension was about 60% of the money that you receive 30 years when you retire came from investment. It came from the money being put away. Your money goes in. The city money goes in. And it invests over 30 years. And 60% of that money was not what was put in, it was what the return was. Now you've got a situation where a risk-free return, which is a 10-year note, which is the federal government, pension funds buy them all the time, were like 4% forever, 4.5% forever. That was your base rate. Then all you had to do is, you know, do some other little higher risk stuff, and you got up to the 7% return and you were fine. Now the federal government's got it at 1.5%. So all you're doing now is taking risk, risk, risk. And what are we seeing here today? California is now going to say, pension funds that have all the money they need, right? We want your returns to be higher. We'll let you borrow.
Mm-hmm.
So now the pension fund, who has oodles of cash, is going to borrow just to get a higher return because they want to borrow that 1.5% money
cheaper
and then go, you know, put it on black or red. which is just crazy.
Well, this is where the national implications are, because I do think this has this very creepy feeling of the run up to the mortgage crisis in 2008.
All the pension funds across the country have to compete with those deals. They're all going to have to do it. So when California goes out there, I don't care if it's cars or pork, if California does it, the rest of the pension funds are going to have to do it, because there's no like special investments in Idaho or Wisconsin or Illinois. Mm-hmm. They're all looking at the same investments for their returns. Now their competitor is borrowing money, which means the competitor will compete at even a cheaper price, you know, even a higher risk, lower return, to beat out the state of Idaho or Michigan or Illinois.
And the California pension fund managers are so wealthy. They have so much cash behind them when they make a decision to invest in red or black, everybody else gets to play along and follow. Similarly, they've used that power to become activist investors.
Absolutely.
David and I talked about the case of Activision, where California, Illinois, New York, and others, you know, what are these big blue states with big government
Blizzard,
unions?
Blizzard,
Yeah, they went after Blizzard and said, you know, like basically, if you don't shape up, we're going to start dropping our investments and
you have some sexual harassment issues, you know. Oh, interesting. Games that are made for boys, pubescent boys that you're going to have a little sexual harassment in that place. No kidding. And it's a problem, and I'm not making fun of it. But the fact of the matter, to have, you know, companies say or investors, you know, we're not going to invest in you until you clean up this act.
Yeah. Well, this may not be our best example, because, you know, clearly you and I are both huge believers in the fact that people ought not to be raped or harassed.
No, agreed. But I mean, that's the level they got to. On the other hand, they'll go out there and say, you didn't put a policy in that says that, you know, you agree that women should be, men should be in women's sports.
Right.
Literally.
Yes.
Men should be in women's sports. You didn't sign that agreement. We're not going to go
invest
in you.
We're not going to invest in you.
Now, again, it's a social issue. There's two sides of that issue. I've got three daughters that play sports. Mm-hmm. You know where I stand on that issue. But no, you can't have the funding be decided by a bunch of other social issues. Yet the far left goes, well, of course we're going to use it, just like you talked about your example earlier. You know, fascism, how do you control the country? Just control the big corporations.
That's right.
Give them the incentives to do whatever, and they don't want to lose their business. They don't want to go out of business. And it's just a fascist kind of, you know, system. Just let the companies handle it.
You just used the F word, and I'm so glad you did, because I do think that that's really what we're seeing, is less kind of government ownership of the means of production than the means of production being owned by people who are compliant and collaborators with really some vile forces. Speaking of which, the abortion industry in California has worked with Gavin Newsom to signal their virtue by allowing, I'm down on number eight here. Gavin Newsom recently came out and declared that California will become a tourist destination for people in need of abortions. And this won't just be limited to people from other states in the union, say Texas, where Senate Bill 8 was recently passed. Everybody knows about Senate Bill 8, which is an attempt to really circumscribe the times during which people can get an abortion. I think it's 6 or 8 weeks or something. I think it's six. But Newsom went farther still and said, no, we're also going to accept people who travel here internationally, and we may have to pay for their airfare, their hotel stay during recovery. We will pay for their surgery if they qualify for our standard of health insurance for the poor. So we are going to become, in Gavin Newsom's worldview, we are again a shining city on a hill offering women easy
reproductive rights.
That's right. And from my own perspective, and I don't ask all listeners to agree with me, it's a death mill. We have now told people all over the country that you can come here and have an abortion at virtually any time, and we'll help pay for that. There's something so utterly grotesque about this as a business enterprise. I mean, imagine Disneyland, where you just went in and killed children. That's sort of my take on this, and I
look at what they're doing for the health insurance of right now. They're getting rid of the copay.
That's right.
I mean, come on. I mean, again, that's not even a right or left. That's not pro-life, pro-choice. That's just like, as a government, we're going to say that if you want to have an abortion, we're going to get rid of the copay.
That's right.
They're not getting rid of the copay for my heart condition.
No.
They're not getting rid of the copay for my broken arm, but for this,
yes,
you know, sanctifying deal, we're going to go ahead and do it.
It's our new First Amendment, really.
Yeah.
So on speaking of paying for the transportation of people across national borders, California has become extraordinarily generous with regard to people coming in from the southern border here. And I just want to point out that we've seen this play out before, that people may come into California because it's the soft white underbelly of, I shouldn't have said white, the soft underbelly of the California immigration system. To get into California is a lot easier than to get into other states. Texas is now...
Well, we immediately give you the health care. We get your kids into school. We solve all these social problems. Everything that's happening down at the border, I'm always amazed when I hear people say, look at all the problems we have at the border. And I'm like, it's just where you're coming from if you think it's a problem.
Mm.
To the people that are allowing it to happen, it's working just fine.
Yeah, not a bug, a feature.
This is a feature. I mean, basically, this is the voter registration program for 2032. It works quite well.
Yeah.
These people are all going to vote for the Democrats, and they know that. And with their population going down, you know, we got to bring people in that are going to vote for us.
And I want to tell one specific, remind people of one specific anecdote, and that was when the entire state was shut down under Gavin Newsom's pandemic protocols. We were allowing people, after Joe Biden got into office, to come roaring into San Diego County, for instance, and we were setting aside hotel rooms for these people. And look, I'm a Catholic guy. My own sense is that I am voluntarily required by my faith to support people who are not able to support themselves and to help the stranger in my midst. Got it. That does not require government action, however, to incentivize people to come into the state. That's dysfunctional. And so in the middle of the pandemic, we had the governor working with teachers unions to say, hey, we've closed your schools, but now we want you to educate kids who are here illegally.
Right.
And we had teachers' unions line up behind that effort in San Diego. So they were stepping over their own children who were waiting to go back to school because it's too dangerous to put our kids back in school in order to teach kids who were here illegally. Just one example of the weird subsidy. And as we saw in Europe, you know, when the Syrian war just exploded, we had refugees pouring out of Syria. And they entered into the softest place they could find, Germany. And from Germany, they had a free EU pass all over the place. This is one of the things that leads to Brexit, of course, right? That people in England and the UK.
Yeah, once you have a passport in any of the countries, you can travel, get jobs and it all. I mean, it's kind of like it's the United States of Europe.
Exactly what's happening here. That's my point. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, people come in through the southern border in California. They come into San Diego, and then you're into the U.S., right? And here we will hand you an identification card, maybe even a driver's license. And once you have that, you have access to other government documents. And with that, you can become something like a citizen with all the rights of a citizen. Almost in San Francisco, you're allowed to vote in local elections, despite the lack of citizenship. And this is now becoming...
But you've lived there for 30 days.
Right.
I mean, come on.
You know the issues. So immigration. And I want to point out one last thing about Merrick Garland, one of my favorite issues here. We've talked about... This is number nine,
yep.
James. The frequent listeners of the podcast will remember that Merrick Garland gets a letter from the National School Board Association on October 4th, I think it is. And the letter says, oh, my gosh, parents are operating as domestic terrorists.
Right.
They're using social media to create false narratives, and they're making it impossible for us to work because they're so dangerous. They are trying to tear down.
They're saying hateful things.
They're saying hateful things. And they're not social distancing and masking, and they're getting upset and saying bad things to us in public meetings, and it's never been a more dangerous time for a school official. We need the FBI to jump in. Garland turns around and immediately orders the FBI in to search out these domestic terrorists. And
that doesn't put a chill on anything, does it?
No,
some knock
not
on your
at
door.
No.
Were you at the school board meeting last week?
Yeah, and did
oh,
you?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you speak? Well, no, I don't really. I was just sitting in the back row. Well, we heard you were at the meeting.
Yes. Who else was there?
Yeah. Are you? Have you ever been a communist?
That's right. So you've got this national effort, which now we know was coordinated by Garland's Department of Justice with the National School Board Association. It was a third party. No huge surprise, the California School Boards Association. On the very same day this letter is submitted to Garland, virtually the same letter is submitted by the California School Board Association to Attorney General Rob Bonta, he who replaced Javier Becerra, and to the governor's office. And the same The same request is being made by the California School Board Association. You've got to crack down because local cops won't do
it. So what you're saying is it didn't happen at the national level first. It was California that tipped it.
What's evident is this thing was coordinated between the national and the state.
The
state of California. That's right. And the California School Board Association. So the two school boards associations worked in concert simultaneously to produce this inevitable outcome that we need law enforcement to jump in on this thing. Now, to their credit, Bonta claims to have like zero communications on this thing within his office. I'm not sure I buy that this document was delivered to him. He is a huge ally of the teachers union. I'm still skeptical, but that was his response to our Public Records Act request at California Policy Center. We sent the same request to Gavin Newsom, and famously Newsom said, his office said, oh, we've got communications, multiple communications, he said, but these are protected by executive right of, executive confidentiality, and we're not going to release them. So there's something amiss here.
from an association.
Yes.
I'm not even a government agency.
Not a government agency.
It's just an association of school boards.
Right. And this is not a public document. It's not something that we can hear about. The governor gets to hide his communications with this group. So we're pretty convinced the California Policy Center, I mean, we can establish that Bonta got the document, but he declares that he did not because he says he has no documents that are responsive to our request.
Yeah.
Zero. Not even the document itself. And then you've got Newsom saying, oh, we've got multiple communications. They're all protected. You can't see them. And then finally, I just want to say that in California, keeping under the rubric here of California's a menace to society, one of my favorite pieces in the last year was Ezra Klein, a former Orange County resident, kid out of Irvine, who went to Berkeley and now writes for The New York Times, syndicated columnist, podcaster, Ezra Klein, very progressive kid. I knew his mother quite well, haven't spoken to her in years, but she babysat our kid. So we were all, traveling the same little social set, but Ezra's gone on
That's
to bigger.
That's back when you were a communist, right?
This is when I was coming out of it, frankly.
Oh, coming out of it. Yeah.
Ezra was already gone by that point when we really became close friends with his mother. But we kept in touch and she knew my politics and didn't approve of them. And, I felt sort of the same about her politics, but she watched our kids and we liked that. And she liked it. It worked for everybody.
You get along.
We get along. But Ezra writes a phenomenal piece in the New York Times in which he says, the headline says almost all of it, California is making liberals squirm. Jim, my point is California is so broken that it is so destructive of the nation that it has even destroyed progressivism now. Not in the way that we might have intended, you and I, but his subhead, Ezra's, is if progressivism can't work in California, why should the country believe it can work anywhere else? He cites an area that is near and dear to your heart, the high cost of housing. He
right.
says out of control housing regulations have limited the supply of housing, therefore, and demand hasn't decreased. Demand has exceeded the supply of housing. Therefore, housing is outrageously expensive, contributing to just one of the factors in California's out of control cost of living. And who does that hurt? It hurts the poor, the progressives claim
right.
to be defending.
The neighborhoods that they're going to go ahead and put apartments in the backyard, it sounds like it's great from It is for the short term. Person owns the house. The value goes up. They do it. But there's no homeowner there anymore.
Yeah.
What's the best way into the middle class? Home ownership. Own your house. You know how you get affordable housing? You live in a house for 30 years and you pay it off.
Right.
It becomes affordable.
That's right.
It's not the 2x4 isn't any different. The concrete's not any different. You just pay off your house. We've been doing it for thousands of years. Pay for your housing, pay for it over time, and you're fine. No, we're going to go ahead and have all these crazy rules that says we're not going to allow anything to get built here. And if it does, we're going to go ahead and put taxes on to do it. Look what's happening in Santa Ana right next door to where we're at right now. Clearly middle class, maybe lower middle class in some areas. What did they go ahead and do? They added a per foot cost for all apartments to go towards affordable housing.
Mm.
So you got middle class people paying a tax for who? Their next door neighbor to subsidize their apartment makes no sense.
So I love what Ezra says here, but he thinks that a lot of California's problem, Jim, is its kind of performative quality, that it's about theater. It's about signaling
theater.
Virtue.
Absolute theater.
He says there's a danger, not just in California, but everywhere. The politics becomes an aesthetic rather than a program. It's a danger on the right, where Donald Trump modeled a presidency that cared more about retweets than bills, but it's also a danger on the left, where the symbols of progressivism are often preferred to the sacrifices and risks those ideals demand. California as the biggest state in the nation and one where Democrats hold total control of the government, carries a special burden. If progressivism cannot work here, why should the country believe it can work anywhere else? Jim, that's all I've got for today. Anything you want to close with?
No, just great being here, enjoying it. And we've been talking to each other for, what, 25 years?
Something like that, almost 30. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
We're almost adults.
We really are. There's a few more years. And I want to thank Brian Tong especially for coming in here and allowing us access to this amazing studio in David's absence. That's all we have time for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show wherever you do that. Please email us your comments and story suggestions and apologies, guys. We have so many great story suggestions. Just the usual cast of podcast listeners has inundated me this past week. I swear I've got 30 stories for a next episode, but sadly that episode will be postponed. David's out of town and I've got guests in the form of three adult children and their wives living in my tiny home, and I'm taking a week off too, so we'll be back with you after January 1st. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and guest here, Jim Righeimer, thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineer Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima. All right. I am with my friend Tony Woodleaf. I've known Tony for a few years now. Are you the executive vice president at State Policy Network?
That's what they tell me.
Okay, good. And for those who are frequent listeners to the show, they will recall that State Policy Network is an association of groups like California Policy Center, and it's how I know most of my best friends these days. Tony, I see that you're not using a fake background. Instead, you're using what looks like a real live bookcase with, I'm going to guess, roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 or 1,500 books.
It is. It's a real live bookcase. Caught them in the wild, brought them all back here, tamed them. I have other bookshelves, but I'm afraid if I touch my camera, I'll mess up something. So you just have to trust me. I like books. It's an unnatural, unabated love for books.
I love it. What are you reading right now that has your interest?
Well, I've got two that I'm into. One is Philip Hamburger's Purchasing Submission. And he, of course, runs the New Civil Liberties Alliance along with Mark Chenoweth. And this book explores the whole idea of fiscal coercion, how federal agencies are basically forcing states to do what they want with the carrot and the stick in vastly unconstitutional ways. So it's a great book so far. I recommend it. And the other, you have a question about that, follow up?
No, please, go ahead.
Oh, okay. The other is a fiction. I always have like a nonfiction fiction going. And this is the third volume in a Norwegian writer, John Foss. It's called the Septology series. And this final volume is called A New Name. And it's, if you like kind of modern literature, there's no punctuation other than question marks and commas. It's very Cormac McCarthy-esque in a Norwegian kind of way, if that makes sense. And it's very perplexing, but also reads very much like an extended three-volume prayer. So,
I once described Cormac McCarthy as a Scandinavian writer writing in English. He's really, the one book I could not make it through on the first three attempts was The Road. Just so irretrievably dark until the very, very end, I think.
It is.
Let's talk about your book, Tony. And that is I, Citizen, A Blueprint for Reclaiming American Self-Governance. I read it and was recommending it to loads of friends, gave a copy to another friend of mine. So I haven't even got it in front of me at this moment, but, I wanted to talk to you about this book in part because A, I know you, and B, I was going to set it aside for, you know, in the pile of books that I mean to get to but almost never do, because there's so many books like this one. And then I started reading it and it struck me as dramatically different from a lot of these other books. It is sort of very contemporary in the sense that it really addresses issues that are in the moment, but it also has this kind of timeless quality. So why don't we start with, I think, you know, you were writing about the divisiveness in politics. And I think it's fair to say, at least in my reading of the book, it's fair to say that you don't think that Americans are actually quite as divided as we might think we are. How did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, yeah. And first of all, thank you for your kind words, Will, and for having me on. Well, you know, my background is in political science. I got my PhD from the University of Michigan, which is still one of the top universities for the study of public opinion, along with the University of Chicago. And so, you know, I didn't specialize in public opinion, but I picked up a little bit while I was there. And so as I began to hear these narratives from pundits on the left and the right about an America that is deeply divided between blue and red, on the verge of civil war, I just saw a columnist in Newsweek suggesting that millions of people are ready to march on the Capitol in 2024 with weapons to shoot it out if their candidate doesn't win. Well, that, first of all, seemed at odds with what I thought I'd learned in school. And it also seems at odds with what I know from regular people out in America. I've got friends who are socialists, libertarians, you know, monarchists, the whole bunch, conservatives, liberals, and they're not angry at each other. And so I decided to dig into the public opinion research, reliable surveys, not the kind of stuff that you see come across your Twitter feed that usually is designed to elicit a response and deceive you into thinking something about what other people believe. And the research is really clear. Most Americans are center to center right. They're very tolerant of one another. They have views that the hard left and the hard right don't like. And they're not at odds. They don't really like politics. They don't like ideology. And the people who are starkly divided is the political class. And that is not just politicians, but their operatives, their consultants, their bundlers, their activists and yes men and pollsters and all the rest. They are the most starkly divided people. And they unfortunately control the narrative right now.
And, you know, I can't help thinking, though, there's that famous, I think it's a attributed to Margaret Mead, the line about don't ever doubt that a small number of people can change the world. That's all that it ever has. So that while the majority of us may not be as radicalized as some, it only takes a few. You know, we've seen this in the summer of 2020 with the social justice rioting. This was not all Democrats. This was not all liberals. And we saw this on January 6th when it was really just, a couple of hundred people who
were
nuts. And that's kind of all it takes to have the rest of us start to feel edgy and anxious. Right. So what about that fact that it doesn't take all of us to be divided? The polls may be misleading in some sense, but perhaps not in another.
No, you've got your finger on it exactly. You know, the University of Notre Dame Press has been slowly translating Solzhenitsyn's wonderful multi-volume history of the Russian Revolution. And if you read that, the picture you get, if you look back to 1905, with the first real attempt at revolution by the communists, and then you see the final culmination in 1718, 19 of the total overthrow of the government and the culture of Russia by the Bolsheviks. And all along, you have this minority that is adamant about what it wants, but it couldn't succeed until you had alongside it the complete decay and debasement and corruption of the elites in other institutions, the church, academia, certainly journalism, and unfortunately the military as well was completely corrupted. So then naturally, having read that, I look for analogs in the U.S., and you do see some disturbing similarities where our ruling institutions are more and more unreliable, not just in terms of their effectiveness, but in terms of their morality. And you see a hard core on the right and the left that are voicing this desire to just seize the reins of power. You see it in the monarchists on the right, the Sohrab Ahmaris, who are unapologetically monarchists. And then you see the woke crowd on the left that hates democracy, even though they say they love it. So you're right. It only takes a relatively small contingent if the majority of people are cowed into silence and indifference. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, is because I think that what's going on is a lot of Americans believe the narrative that most of their countrymen are hard left and hard right and angry, and they feel like they don't have a place. And what I'm trying to show is, no, we're the majority, right? And if we'll step up, run for office, you know, shout down the crazies, you know, show up at rallies, you know, with your moderate signs for centrism, we can keep our country. But if we're quiet, we're going to lose to either the Bolsheviks on the left or the fascists on the right.
Now, you and I are both, I think I'm right in saying this. I'll speak for myself. I'm a constitutional conservative. I'm very much a free market kind of small L libertarian sort of guy. My own life looks remarkably uneventful and Burkean, a tiny little platoon of democracy headed by a dictator. Well, it's my wife. Don't tell her I said so. And I think that it, if I understand correctly, I want to get into your blueprint, because that's the subhead here for your book, is a blueprint for reclaiming American self-governance. And I was most impressed, first of all, the diagnosis that we're not quite as divided as we may think we are is important. And I don't want to just, skip over that. But in the interest of time, I think that's important. You go on to say, how do we stop the slow slide into radicalism? As some of our friends, yours and mine, I won't mention by name, have found themselves on the side of kind of the Flight 93 mentality. That we cannot. I mean, I will mention one because he's published this a lot, and in his book, Charles Kessler's new book, I think it's called the Crisis of the Two Constitutions, I believe it is.
I think that's right.
In which he really kind of says, look, there's a disagreement about the fundamental nature of the Constitution, and it can only be resolved by secession, or surrender, secession, or civil war. Partly I worry about that as a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think the more you say it, the more people are inclined to believe its inevitability.
That's right.
What can we do? You mentioned, heading out on the street with our I'm a radical centrist placards, and I guess refusing to gather with the commies on the left and the fascists on the right.
Yeah, yeah.
What else?
Well, yeah, so I wanted to, I think you're exactly right. It's people are being radicalized. And we could talk more about that. But what I wanted to do is I didn't want to end the book with a magic wand that says, okay, now let's have federalism and mean it, or Congress will reform itself. Members of Congress will start doing their jobs. These are unrealistic. So I wanted to give a list of things that any reader of the book at the end can do, anyone. And I began with the thing that you have the most control over, and that is yourself. So what can I do within myself? And the first thing I suggest is love your neighbor. And I talk a little bit about what that means. It's not a sentiment. Love, love is an action, right? It's not a love song. It's an action. So what does it look like to love your neighbor? And then what do you get from that? And then once you've worked within yourself, you work out into your neighborhood. What can you do alongside your neighbors to make your neighborhood better? And then what can you do collectively to take back your town if you need to inject yourselves in the running of your community? And then from there, I say a lot about the necessity of working with state-based groups. In fact, the middle part of the book, I kind of lay out how the federal government, they have become the enemy of the people. It's not red versus blue. It's a political class controlling DC, largely unelected, waging war on the way of life of everyone in every community, through federal agencies and executive orders and court decisions and the rest of it. So then the states, state-based groups like CPC, like groups across the country, they're the only hope we have of calling to account federal abuse and then hopefully inspiring some congressional action, legal action, and all the rest of it. So you go from yourself out to your state, and all along the way, what are things you can do? And the underlying idea is, as we begin to re-knit our communities and take action at that local level, we rediscover the things that bind us that transcend red versus blue. And that's a more stable basis for long-term political action. But it's just not a quick fix.
Well, because you know me, that I live right between the Pacific Ocean and the warm embrace of the frigid Sierras. And in a state that has 40 million people and who just turned down an opportunity to recall a governor who I would argue is every bit as threatening to individual sovereignty, as you describe it, as the federal government. And in fact, this governor and many before him have looked at California as sort of not just a lighthouse, but actually a fillip, a whip to get the federal government to become more activist. When Trump is in power, we sue him, I think a record more than 100 times over this mandate or that. Now that Biden's in office, we're hoping that he will simply incorporate into federal policy, as he has policies that were at one point specific to California. And more than that, California just takes action in with regard to, say, climate change initiatives or wildfire management in public employees in ways that are hostile to, in some respects, the Constitution, and certainly out on the leading edge of Democratic progressive thinking. What would your advice be to us? Is it follow that mandate of, you know, you got to get involved with your neighbors left and right, and, you know, love those neighbors. But most of those neighbors out here of mine are, you know, they're voting for the kind of woke policies and environmental stuff that is destroying not just this state, but others.
Yeah, no, you're right. You know, what's interesting about California, I was looking at this data a year ago, and there's some interesting data on that you can get a sense for politically, where are the majority of your citizens in your state, you know, on the left-right spectrum, as much as they'll stake out ground. And then you can compare that to the position of your elected officials in the state, your from your governor on down to mayors, where or what are their policy positions? And then you can see the gap between where the people are politically, ideologically, and where the rulers are. California has the biggest gap. The people are more conservative than their elected officials. And so then you have to step back and say, okay, well, why isn't the Republican Party competitive in enough areas? And you kind of try to break that down. But I don't think you take the state back any other way than through this beginning with local organization and communication. But you also need thriving state-based groups to start to pull those folks together. And that means a legal effort, a grassroots effort, everything you're trying to build in California. There's just no quick substitute for that ground game, which takes a little time. But where I think you can take heart is there's a lot of Californians who are not crazy loony liberals, right? The southern intellectual part of the state is not the entirety of the state of California. And I think the hubris of the left there is what will be their undoing.
Yeah. I think you're right. And we've seen a lot of that. Our listeners know we report on this weekly. It's sort of the internal contradictions of the Marxist model. And you're starting to see self-described progressive left liberals in places like San Francisco recall their school board over woke curriculum initiatives, recall their district attorney. And there's a separate recall going on down here in Los Angeles. Similarly, district attorney who's got these decriminalization policies that have huge shock led to a spike in criminal activity. Let me ask you this. You and I both share not just a faith. I don't think that's the right word, because faith makes it sound like a leap across a chasm of rational thinking. But we've looked at the evidence, you and I, and federalism really works. That's a key component of your prescription, I guess. I could say it that way, for how to take the country back. Federalism. What is it you think that federalism is uniquely designed to do in a country that is putatively divisive?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, part of what you get with federalism, and then there's subsidiarity, right? This desire to push decisions as close as possible to the communities that will be affected by them, which is a fundamentally democratic, with a small d, democratic impulse, right? Let the people govern their own lives and their communities. And part of the reasoning for that is the closer the decision is to where people who are affected by it live, the easier it is for them to get to the decision makers and express either their approval or their disapproval. The easier it is when you have smaller units of authority, the easier it is for a regular citizen to run for office, because it takes shoe leather. Even today, in this world dominated by money and politics, once you get down to the school board level, when as long as you don't have these crazy school boards like Loudoun County, Virginia, that it's trying to govern an area of geography half the size of Rhode Island, right? It's ridiculous how they've set it up. But in a reasonably sized district for a school board, any one of us can run for it. And we don't need a bunch of money and the approval of the teachers' unions. We can do it. But once you start pulling those decisions up to the states and then to the feds and then put them in unelected places, there's no opportunity for the people to protest or run in opposition. So that to me is the chief reason for federalism. The other reason is when you try to nationalize all these decisions, you make enemies of Americans. Right now, why do we all pick on people in San Francisco, or you liberals out in California, or the people up in New York? Well, because there's a stereotype, right? That they're a certain way. They're too liberal, and they want to tell us in North Carolina, where I live, how to live. And then those folks there are probably making fun of my redneck neighbors because we don't know how to run our lives. It turns us into enemies. Whereas if we can keep our decisions local, then we can have a spirit of comity towards one another. Let the San Franciscos run their city the way they want. It doesn't bother me. I won't go there if I don't like it. And then the same for North Carolina. So I think there's a couple of those reasons are why federalism works, you know, and it clearly works.
I want to switch. We only have a couple of minutes left here, but I wanted to switch, if I can, to something that I think you touch on at several points in the book, but I'll call it, for lack of a better word, it's almost psychological or spiritual. And that is, you talked about loving your neighbor, clearly a spiritual invocation there, not unique to Christianity, but, you know, sort of built into the DNA of America. We are, to some extent, we are our brother's keepers. You and I interpret that quite differently than, say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Elizabeth Warren. But I wonder, what are you looking for in the individuals? I'm in California. Let's call it personal transformation. But too often, I think, you know, the encouragement to change the politics misses the internal change that must occur in me. Right. Too often the phone call is coming from inside the house. You know, the terrorist that I'm really afraid of lives inside my brain. What would your advice be to us in thinking about the need to transform our own way of viewing the world? You start with that, I think, observation that we're not quite as divided as you may think. You don't need to separate the world into blue and red. Can you dig into that and tell me what's your guidance there for us Californians who may, you know, there's 5 million Republicans or so. That's larger than, you know, I don't know, almost half the states and territories of the United States. Big number of conservatives. They feel overwhelmed. I'm a conservative. I sometimes feel overwhelmed. It's a tsunami of bad info. What's your coaching to someone like me who lives in California and needs to transform personally? Again, I know you've already said, love your neighbor. Got
sure,
it.
Sure.
How do I do this?
I think a part of it is, you know, we've got to get past the mentality that to fix something in this country, it means to get together a temporary coalition of 51% of the voters and take power and ram through as much as we can of the good stuff from our textbook, whether it's Karl Marx or Milton Friedman, while we have the power. And what if instead we operate from the point of view that we're only winning when we can persuade 60, 70, 80% of our neighbors to go along with our policy? What if we didn't try to just win on a bare majority, but we tried to win over one another? How might that change our politics, what we're willing to settle for, what we're willing to push for, and how might it make us more empathetic? When we start to think, golly, I got to persuade 70% of my neighbors of this, I better start to try to understand why they don't want it, because maybe I'm making some bad assumptions about its merit or what they know or don't know. And I think that's an older view of democracy, and it's what the founders had in mind, was to strive for comity, not a mathematical temporary victory.
I love it. That's Tony Woodleaf, my friend, and the author of I, Citizen, A Blueprint for Reclaiming American Self-Governance. We can find that book literally almost everywhere books are sold. Tony, great book. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Will. Thanks for having me on.
We'll talk to you again on your next book. What is the next book going to be?
You know, that's a good question. I can't tell you yet. I'm still thinking about it.
All right. Well, I'll run into you and you'll tell me then. Tony Woodleaf, my friends, thanks very much.